This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. The Charles W. Morgan is the last remaining wooden whaling ship. Fresh off a five-year, $7.5 million restoration, she's been touring southern New England's waters on her first voyage in almost a century, and her last for the foreseeable future. The ship recently visited Stellwagen Bank. When the Charles W. Morgan was built, this area was a rich whaling ground. Now, it's a National Marine Sanctuary and considered critical habitat for the endangered whales the Charles W. Morgan's crew once pursued. The ship's return to Stellwagen Bank was an opportunity for scientists and advocates aboard to remember the past, reflect on lessons learned, and add what some consider a redeeming chapter to the Charles W. Morgan's long history. The day began with a brief message from Second Mate Sean Burkaw.
Okay, I'm going to start because we got places to go, people see, things to do. Okay, my name's Sean Burkaw. I'm the second mate. This is just a quick safety brief.
In addition to his official duties on the Charles W. Morgan, Burkaw is continuing his own informal study of ocean currents.
Right, well, for the last 40 years, off and on, I've been doing a message in a bottle experiment, and it seems like appropriate to continue the project out here. So we'll send this adrift, and hopefully we'll hear back.
Burkaw pens a quick note with the date and a request that the finder get in touch.
So what I do is then I put in also the information about the Charles W. Morgan, which gives a little bit of their background. But one of the things that worries me is having the people get the note out of the bottle without having to break the bottle. And if you just stick the note in, you roll it up and stick it in, it'll expand again, and then you pretty much have to break. So one of the things I've done, because I'd hate to get a call and say, I found your bottle, now I'm going to sue you because I cut my hand or something. So I roll it up around a pencil.
He tapes it in place.
Beth, can I get your help for one sec? Can you just pinch this right here?
I can do it.
Then Burkaw inserts the small scroll and corks the bottle.
And then I found that if you push it down this way, and we're set to go. So then once we get out to Stellwagen Bank, with the blessing, hopefully, of Noah, will launch us out. Ready? All right, to the deep.
When you throw a bottle overboard, do you keep any records for yourself about what you threw over where?
Yes, a great question, yeah. Especially when I'm at sea where I have more control of it. I write down the latitude and longitude, and I give each bottle a number. In a way, I'm doing that here because I put a date on so I know which leg we're on. But then that's been really helpful because I've had like two bottles that went one day apart, and one was found after a year and a half, and one was found after 10 years. But because of the number, I knew exactly where they went in. So then because I'm interested both in the people and of the project, but also the science and of how long, what currents are playing into carrying the bottles.
Mariners have used messages in bottles for centuries as a means of emergency communication. Scientists also use them as an early way to study ocean currents. Today, bottles have been replaced by drifters equipped with GPS or satellite communications, and those were also on board the Charles W. Morgan. Michael Whitney from the University of Connecticut at Avery Point had 8 GPS drifter buoys to deploy, and ironically, they were being stored in the large metal trying pots that once rendered blubber into oil.
That wasn't my first choice, but it's pretty appropriate.
So what's the goal with the drifter study?
The goal with it is just to establish the connections in the ocean and to look at, well, we're in the sanctuary now, the water that's here right now, where is it going to go over the next days to weeks to months? And those patterns of currents that these drifters will track change day to day, month to month, and year to year. So it's also part of a larger program. This is part of the a drifter program run out of the NOAA's Northeast Fishery Science Center. And they've had hundreds of drifters looking at different current patterns and all the various roads that the water can take away from areas like this and to this, actually.
So give us a little tour of the drifter here.
Oh, yeah, this is a drifter without its arms, but the top part is the brains. This is the GPS, the drifter, and it will get its position every 2 hours and then send it back by satellite to the web every 2 hours, and hopefully it'll do that for months. If it survives. And then right down to this orange tape, that's where the water line is. So everything above this sticks out of the water. Everything below it is in the water. And what's missing right now is the sails. The sails are not like the sails on the Morgan to catch the wind. They're actually catching the water. So it moves along with the current. And you can see those up assembled up there.
I mean, you've got kind of an eclectic mix of flotation.
We do. We're trying to reuse. And so it's flotation up on top, and then we'll have weights on the bottom, which are little barbell weights.
So deliberate choice to use plastic bottles, and they're filled with what, like foam insulation?
Foam. Expanding foam. And then the arms of the sails are bamboo. And then the sails themselves were decorated by, or the artwork is from the kindergartners, first graders, and second graders from Northeast Academy in Groton, Connecticut. And my two daughters, Annabelle and Charlotte, too. So they helped out. They were happy to do it, but they're not exactly okay with the idea of releasing it to the ocean without getting it back. But we've taken pictures, so we've documented it.
How new would the knowledge coming from these be? I mean, how good an understanding do we have of the currents in this area?
I think we have an idea of the general flow patterns. There's often a southward flow offshore of Cape Cod that continues even down to Cape Hatteras. We have that sense, but what we really don't know about is the variability. How strong it is today versus last week or last year, and then it can even shift directions too. But one thing that we're looking at in oceanography right now is how you get out of coastal waters into the ocean waters and vice versa. And hopefully some of these drifters will show those pathways.
I never cease to be amazed by how much we don't know, especially about an area where people have been fishing and whaling for hundreds of years. It's only a few miles offshore, and yet there's still so much more to learn.
Oh, definitely. And I think it's that you can't just map this. It's ever-changing. So even though we might know exactly what's happening today, which I don't think we do, actually, if we did, it wouldn't tell us what's going to happen tomorrow or next year. So we've got to be out there all the time.
Anne DeMonte of the Audubon Society of Rhode Island was on board the Charles W. Morgan, making observations much the same way whalers would have a century or more ago. Although technology has progressed, she says whalers were the first whale researchers, and their observations remain an important scientific resource.
I did a survey of my colleagues in the field and from various institutions all over New England, and almost 80... actually higher than that, about 85% of them all said they used some kind of historical whaling documentation in their research at some point in their lives.
Are there specific tools, or can you point to specific, as you were saying, even the physiology of the animals that we know from whalers?
Right. A lot of us look back at logbooks, charts, talking about currents and things like that. And then, yes, there's certain people like... works of Allen, those were Shaman, those were all historical whaling documents that recorded actually measurements of whales. They got the internal organs, they recorded all that kind of stuff, and many of us still pull those reference materials out today, and they're well over 150 years old.
Clearly the whalers had some idea that they were changing the whale populations. I mean, they basically whaled on Stellwagen Bank until they couldn't anymore, and then they went to grounds further and further and further away. Do you think they had a sense of what they were doing to whale populations?
I really don't think they did. I don't think they thought with the conservation efforts we did today. I think, if anything, they thought about, oh, the whales are no longer here. I have to go further to make my dollar, so to speak. And I think they probably thought of it in dollars and cents. I don't think until later did they ever think about that the resource would run out. I just don't think they had the same mentality we do today about the ocean is not endless as far as the resources we can pull from it. Today, we're very tuned into, or we try to be, finding sustainability between humans' needs for the ocean and preserving the marine ecosystems. But I don't think back then they truly had that understanding. They just thought it would go on forever, I think. And they didn't use the oceans like we do today for all the various, because not only do we use it for finding resources such as oil, we do, of course, fisheries. We do things like putting windmills in sounds now and stuff like that. So that's changed how we use it. And actually, that was one of my questions to my colleagues, were, do you think that 19th century mariners had a greater effect on marine population than we do today, marine mammal population. And believe it or not, 40% of them say that we have a greater effect today on marine mammal populations than the whaling did.
How so? What is it that we're doing now that would be even more of a detriment than whaling?
Right. Unfortunately, today, a huge amount of whales die from entanglement in fishing gear, particularly right whale population. There's only about less than 500 North Atlantic right whales left in the world, and just about all of them that we documented have scarring from entanglement. There's also ship strike issue. There's chemical pollutants, noise pollutants, habitat destruction, destruction of the habitats. Their food resources are being affected by our pollutants and things like that. So compared to strict whaling in the 18th and 19th century, there's a lot more going on today. Of course, not everyone agrees. Some people say whaling had a greater impact, but a good colleague of mine, Michael Morris, says, are we still whaling today? We just call it something different, unfortunately. So we're still having an effect on marine mammal populations.
Given the way that you actually use information from whalers, how does it feel to you to be on the Charles Morgan?
Well, I'm a marine biologist, and my area studies marine mammalogy, so this is the greatest honor I could ever experience to see what these whalers actually experienced or tried to experience their lives. Gives me a better understanding towards marine conservation. I mean, we definitely don't want to glorify whaling. We'll never go back to that, knock on wood. But back then, it wasn't the same mentality we had today. They needed the whales to survive. The whales were providing something that humans needed to survive. The amount of whales they actually caught compared to the amount of whales today that, say, get entangled in fishing gear, is this sort of a balance to that. Again, we don't call it anymore whaling anymore, but maybe we still do. So I don't think we're trying to glorify whaling. I think we're trying to learn from it and learn better how we can conserve the populations in the future. And I think the Morgan can now be an ambassador to that. She's turned the tides and come full circle back to now conserving the populations instead of hunting them.
Someone earlier said that she's finally doing right by the whales.
I like that. That's true. She is. She is doing right by the whales. Absolutely. But I think she, all along, I mean, if these whalers didn't go out back then and record what they did and experience life around the world, we may not have the knowledge that we do today as oceanographers. So today, it's easy. We can go online and we can Google. But in the 18th century, people relied on these whalers to come back from all the corners of the globe and tell them about the world around them. The world would have been pretty flat as far as our knowledge if it wasn't for mariners like those that traveled on the Morgan.
That was marine biologist Anne DeMonte. You're listening to a special episode of Living Lab, excerpts from a voyage to Stellwagen Bank
this
aboard
is
the
whaling
lab.
Ship
I'm Heather
Charles
Goldstone.
W. Morgan.
The return
this
of the
whaling
ship
in Charles W.
whales
Morgan
for the
to
Stellwagen
Bank
almost
earlier this
a
summer
was an opportunity
that moment,
for reflection
plus
a conversation
on just
with
how
ocean
much
advocate Sylvia
towards whales
about the change she takes from the Charles
progression
W.
of
Morgan.
History was visible
That's
not
up.
Only aboard the Charles W. Morgan, but also in the other boats that accompanied her on this leg of the voyage.
In addition to whale-watching cruises and recreational fishing boats, there was the historic Eastern Rig fishing trawler, Roanne, also owned and restored by Mystic Seaport, and at the far end of the spectrum, the NOAA research vessel, Auk. John Bullard is one person steeped in all of these eras in maritime history. He's currently the Northeast Regional Administrator for the National Marine Fisheries Service, but he's also been mayor of New Bedford, and he spent a stint as the director of Sea Education Association, which uses tall ships similar to the Charles W. Morgan for research and education. Bullard was standing at the ship's rail, pondering the symbolism of the historic assemblage visiting Stellwagen Bank, when the Charles W. Morgan encountered a whale for the first time in almost a century.
The vessel we're on here, whale ships, you're not allowed to whale anymore. But it was an important fishery for several hundred years. My hometown in New Bedford depended on it and lit the world. I mean, it provided a very important function. But the kind of whaling that took place on this vessel, very different than the industrialized whaling that takes place, that has taken place over the last 50 years. And so I think symbolically, especially for this vessel of Charles W. Morgan, having spent her life in pursuit of whales, it's symbolically very important to come out here to Stellwagen Bank, where because of conservation measures, the whale populations in the Northwest Atlantic are all moving in the right direction. And so I think it's an opportunity for the Morgan, who I think has feelings, to come out and be among the creatures that she pursued all over the globe. Maybe make peace, I don't know. I think to have the Roanne, the fishing vessel alongside us, shows that going to sea can be and should be a continuing effort. I know that's, again, from my hometown in New Bedford, one of the things that I like most about New Bedford is history continues. That Herman Melville, if he were to walk around the streets of New Bedford, wouldn't get lost. There's still all the functions. The vessels like the Roanne don't go out for 3, 4, 5 years the way the Morgan did, but they go out for 10 days or so. You still, you know, miss birthdays and anniversaries. Life at sea gets romanticized, but it's tough, it's dangerous, it's hard work, it can be boring at times, terrifying at others. And whatever it is, it changes the people who do it. And sounds
all
like
right,
someone
we've got a
spotted
whale.
A whale.
Right there.
Boom. So, here we are.
You said you think
W. Morgan has not been near a whale in, almost 100 years. And this is an amazing feeling.
You said you think the ship has feelings. What's she feeling?
Well, I think she's had nothing but great feelings thanks to the work that Mystic Seaport has done to restore her and then to sail her because it's every time you leave port, it's a risk. And it's a difficult decision for Mystic to take the last remaining whale ship and take it out to sea because you don't want to be the person who loses it. There's only one left. And so I commend Mystic for being willing to responsibly take that risk and get the Morgan sailing and healing and taking at sea. And I think she feels it. And I think she's got to be one happy ship right now. I mean, this is what ships are made to do. They're made to go out to sea. They're made to sail. So she's doing what she's made to do. It's like anybody. You feel better when you're doing what you're made to do.
Of course, what the Charles W. Morgan was originally made to do was kill whales for profit. Its retirement in 1921 was an economic decision as much as anything. But in the 50 years that followed, attitudes toward whales changed dramatically. University of Vermont conservation biologist Joe Roman.
As this boat makes clear, the value of whales for most of human history, since we started knowing anything about whales, was in the oil and the meat and the baleen that they would have. So what was the value when you pulled them out of the ocean? In the 1960s, we started to change that view and become aware that whales make interesting sounds underneath the water. We started diving and starting to see what the oceans look like from a whale's perspective, and that changed everything. At the same time, in the 60s and early 70s, there was widespread acknowledgement that whale populations were in trouble and could indeed go extinct if we didn't stop hunting them. So in this 1973, U.S. passed the Marine Mammal Protection Act, and no longer could we kill whales, seals, and other marine mammals. That makes a huge difference. And then in the 1980s, the International Whaling Commission stops whaling completely, all commercial whaling. And since then, what we're beginning to understand is that whales aren't just valuable for the products they provide, but also for the ecosystem services and the ecological function that they have in the oceans.
I mean, there have been a few studies that have come out in the past couple of years showing just how important whales are to their ecosystems, that they can even make fisheries stronger.
That's right. So that's some work that colleagues of mine at Harvard and some folks down in the Southern Hemisphere have been looking at. We know that whales dive down to feed, and they feed on copepods, krill, which are zooplankton, and fish. When they come to the surface, they rest, they breathe, and they also poop. So they're releasing these nutrients at the surface, and that those nutrients help phytoplankton, help algae grow. So you can actually have more whales, more phytoplankton, more zooplankton, and more fish in a system. So that's work that's been going on globally. The initial work that we did was right here in Stellwagen Bank. We were collecting whale feces from humpbacks and other species about 4 or 5 years ago, looking at that very question.
And not just in terms of present-day fisheries, but going into the future with climate change, whales could potentially play a role in how the ocean copes with climate change.
That's right, in a couple of ways. So one is this nutrient pump, right? By increasing productivity, you'll have more algae in the water, and that'll drop out and lock in some carbon. But also, we don't have large trees in the ocean. Most of the growth is through microscopic organisms. We do have large animals, though, among the largest animals that ever lived on Earth. So we have these whales, when they die, they bring all those nutrients into the deep sea. We see strandings here, and that occasionally happens, but the vast majority of whales, when they die, drop out into the deep sea. Where they're going to bring those nutrients down to the bottom, that provides food for dozens of organisms that depend on that species, on whales, and also others that move around between whales and hydrothermal vents. So that's important to lots of species, but it's also a way to sequester carbon, to lock carbon away in the deep sea. So that's going to help us. Just like we talk about geoengineering the planet, trying to change things in order to cope with climate change, one way is by recovering whales, actually. That's going to help us a small bit. We have to do our part. Humans have to change the way we use fossil fuels if we're going to make the big difference. But whales can play a small part, too.
What were the forces that drove the shift in public perceptions towards whales? I mean, was it purely just this ability to dive and see them in their own habitat, or were there other social and economic factors at play?
One thing is for sure, the whales weren't that valuable anymore because there weren't that many. So whaling industry had declined. And some people argue it didn't matter how much we protested, the whaling industry was going to go away anyway. I would argue, well, that may be true, but the whales might have disappeared too. Had we not stopped before they went to the very end, they could have gone extinct as well. So one was economics. Two were cultural shifts. There were rising conservation movements in the 1960s and early 70s. Whales were at the forefront of that, I think. Save the whales, Greenpeace, those sort of activist movements to save animals and plants. Really, whales were one of the earliest ones on that. Another important part was the idea that whales were conscious, that they had songs. So songs of the humpback whale, recorded by Roger Payne in the early 70s, makes a big difference. People all of a sudden hear these beautiful underwater sounds, and that rocks the world in a lot of ways, and I think people start change. They think it's not right to just look at these whales as meat or as oil. It wasn't going to be some small organism, the Mussel Protection Act, for example, or the Snail Protection Act. It was the marine mammals because people cared about them. Soon after that, after the whales and other marine mammals are protected, then we had a law that protected all species, that all species had the right to exist. So I think they really were at the forefront of that.
Would you say that conservation efforts with regard to whales have been successful?
Yeah, so my colleagues and I did a paper on the Marine Mammal Protection Act, came out last year, and what we found is that 60% of the species of all marine mammal populations have increased in recent years since they were protected. That's a pretty good, it's not an overwhelming success, but compared to trajectories for lots of other species, let's think of corals, which are in decline, amphibians in decline, the good news is by stopping the hunt for these species, lots of species have rebounded. Humpback whales, for example, now number in the tens of thousands. Sperm whales are in the millions now, so they're doing very well. and lots of other species. You could think of gray seals and other species around here. They've become far more abundant, even in our lifetimes, even in the past 10 or 20 years. So Marine Mammal Protection Act has been very effective, as has the international, the moratorium on commercial whaling. So there's an international moratorium that stopped whaling in the 1980s. Not all countries comply, but the vast majority of them do, and that's really resulted in a big increase in whale populations as well.
Sorry.
Many aboard felt this voyage of the Charles W. Morgan was a chance for the ship to make amends for its history. It was a sentiment voiced rather humorously during a late afternoon encounter with a humpback whale feeding right off the starboard side.
Woohoo! I think that was an apology accepted.
But marine biologist and ocean advocate Sylvia Earle says there's no apology necessary.
I don't fault those who did not appreciate what we now can appreciate. But the idea today, of course, it doesn't make any sense. But it really is baffling that so people went so far and used such effort, so much risk in the latter days of whaling to still continue to take the last few whales that they could squeeze out of the ocean when it was clear that we could kill them all if we wanted to. And, but what's remarkable, I suppose, is our ability to look at the evidence and think about it and change our behavior, change our ways. We did it with birds, we did it with whales, we're starting to do it with at least some kinds of fish, as we understand that there are limits to what we can take out of the ocean, out of wildlife, period, anyway. And to realize that there are other values that transcend just pounds of meat or barrels of oil or products of any sort.
What did it feel like to see that first whale alongside the Morgan, knowing that that's the first time probably in almost 100 years that this boat has been close to a whale? But, of course, today we're not here to harvest them.
Well, it's a great symbol of the change of our attitude. That here is a vessel that was dedicated to killing whales, now dedicated to understanding and caring for them, if you will, getting people to see the other values. It's, I can't think, a cause for hope.
I was going to ask you, would you consider this one of the rays of hope?
Definitely. The Charles Morgan, Charles W. Morgan is a ship of hope, carrying, in a sense, a lot of the weight of history as it moves through the ocean to the future. And it's a remarkable time that we share right now. We have the knowledge that has been accumulated from all preceding time. Kids who come along today can, in a very short period of time, accumulate what it has taken centuries, even millennia, to discover. So they're armed with new knowledge, new insight, and access to knowledge. Many kids, at least. Not all 7 billion of the people on the planet, but a fair number have access to knowledge that they carry in their pocket. The Library of Congress, access to people all over the planet. New information instantly available to a wide number of individuals. So that's all one of the greatest reasons for hope.
Do you think that a whaling ship like this, that to many of those kids with cell phones in their pockets would seem so foreign, does this have the ability still to resonate and carry a message?
Well, to the extent that we can convey through images, through words, through songs, through whatever it is that humans use to use the power of knowledge, of communicating. Absolutely, this is a three-dimensional, tangible piece of the past. And anyone, myself included, can stand on the bow of this vessel and imagine what it was like to see a whale with the eyes of a whaler. The idea that, I mean, what they could see were dollar signs. Now we appreciate those other values. We see them as not only sentient beings, it's respect for what keeps us alive, respect for responsibilities we have as a creature that is changing the nature of nature, not only influencing our future, but all of the rest of life on Earth as well. And the awareness that our lives depend on maintaining the integrity of the living systems that underpin everything we care about. Like breathing, for example. If we like to breathe, we will certainly be respectful of the organisms that photosynthesize, whether it's on the land or in the sea, because we don't know how to just make a planet that works in our favor. Our economy depends on it. Our health depends. Everything depends on having a planet that works in our favor. That means really understanding it. And this vessel, the Charles W. Morgan, gives us some perspective about a time when much that we now take for granted was simply not known. We thought the ocean was infinite in its capacity to yield whatever we want to take out of it or whatever we want to put into it. Great dumping ground, great place to extract things. Well, there's still some evidence of people who believe that even now, but looking at the knowledge, looking at the facts, looking at the track record, we now can see ourselves in new ways, with new eyes, and realize the ocean, most importantly, gives us life. And now it's our turn to return the favor.
In addition to carrying its message of hope and respect, the Charles W. Morgan is providing some voyagers with insights they couldn't glean any other way. Coming up, we'll hear what one maritime archaeologist has learned. Living Lab's visit with the Charles W. Morgan continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. The Charles W. Morgan is the last remaining wooden whaling ship. After 80 years and 37 whaling voyages, she was retired in 1921, and she's been dockside or on land ever since. Until now, that is. This summer, the Charles W. Morgan is making a 38th voyage, her first in nearly 100 years, and her last for the foreseeable future. It's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for the crew and passengers aboard. For Jason Ropp, an archaeology student who studies the remains of wrecked whaling ships, it's been particularly informative.
My project, my PhD research, is wrecked whale ships in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. And a lot of the artifacts that we find are pretty obvious by function or type, you know, because they maintain their shape. But there are a lot of other things that we find that the coral growth and sort of the concretion, the deterioration of the artifacts has sort of changed their shape a bit. So I'm hoping to be able to look at some of the objects that work, fittings and things in the rigging, and identify some of those things on the shipwreck sites. So,
I mean, how much knowledge have we lost in, you know, 100, 150 years since these whaling ships were still sailing around to go out and not be able to necessarily identify what we're looking at on these wrecks?
Well, I don't know if it that's a good question. I think we're really fortunate because a lot of these whalers came back and shared their experiences. Either they were literate enough to record their own stories and narratives, or they shared with other people who helped them to document their time on board the ships. And what you find in a lot of that is that they discuss the material culture. So they not only tell you the experiences they have while they're out offshore and, you know, chasing whales and trying out oil, but also just they are very descriptive at times of the ship itself, I guess because it was their home for such a long time.
Now, you've been walking around all day with this meter-long black and white rod that has attracted some curiosity and a few theories about what it might be. So what is it actually?
It's a photo scale. It's a 1 meter photo scale. So it has increments of 10 centimeters and alternating in black and white. And this is archaeological photography, you know, it's a standard that you have a scale included. Generally, we also try to have a north arrow. However, because this is an extant ship, it's not as necessary. So
And we've been facing a lot of different directions today.
Right, right. So it's not as easy. But certainly the photo scale is a key piece of what we use, because there are times like here where this is an active ship, it's a working platform. You've got, the crew constantly changing tack and, changing the sails, changing the rig. So oftentimes we don't have the luxury to record things in detail. But what we can do if we've taken the photographs that have a scale in them, then we can extrapolate size from that. So, and that can be really helpful.
How unique and important an experience is it to be able to get onto an actual restored whaling ship? And what kind of perspective do you think that'll give you the next time you go back to a wreck on the bottom of the ocean?
Oh, I think it's especially that the Charles W. Morgan is the last remaining wooden whale ship that was built in its period. And I think that this opportunity is can't really be compared in terms of an experience that you take with you when you go to look at wrecks, on the seabed. Again, I think the important thing is the sites that I've looked at for my PhD, and then I've worked with archaeologists from the Papahanaumokuakea Marine National Monument in Hawaii, is that they're in very tropical environments. They're in very open ocean, really rough environments. So there's absolutely no wooden structure left. So when we talk about shipwrecks, we're not necessarily referring to what I think a lot of people think of, and that's, a large section of the hull that's preserved under the seabed. What we find is just scattered pieces of the ship, and it's generally these metal fittings. So for this experience to see a square rigger being sailed, in person is, I think it's an undeniable, help to what I'll be able to achieve.
Yeah, to actually see all the pieces put together.
Yeah.
Have you gotten out of your trip so far what you were hoping to?
I have. There's certain artifacts that we've recorded on the seabed. I've guessed at their purpose and their function for several years. I'm in the sort of final analysis stages of my PhD research, so this will allow me to go back and kind of settle some things for myself. And I've spoke with the blacksmith who created most of the metal fittings for the refit for this voyage, and he's confirmed or explained to me what some of these things are, so that really allows me to feel with much more certainty that what we've identified are pieces of the rigging, for instance, like yard trusses and things like that. So
how did you first get interested in marine archaeology and specifically whaling ships?
I was an undergraduate archaeology anthropology major, and some guys came to town to, I live in a small town in Louisiana, and they came to town to do surveys on the Red River, and so I met them, and they brought me out on their boat and introduced me to archaeological remote sensing, and I was hooked from that point. I didn't want to do terrestrial archaeology that much anymore. So, and whaling, my master's thesis was on New England-built schooners and how they were reused in the Gulf of Mexico and the snapper fisheries. And during that time, I started to study. My study moved into whaling a little bit in terms of research. And then my wife and I moved to Australia about 8 years ago. In Australia, whaling was a very important export industry for the early Australian colonies. So it's just been a slowly developing interest.
Here in Massachusetts, I think there's a lot of awareness that whaling is a part of our history, was a big part of the economy, of culture. But I think sometimes it's easy to forget how global this was, that ships like the Charles W. Morgan were going to Hawaii, to Australia, to these really far-flung parts of the world, and that this is really a global history story.
Well, it is. It's we currently one of the shipwrecks we documented in Hawaii is a shipwreck called the Two Brothers. And it is the captain of the whale ship Essex, a pretty famous story. Kind of gave Melville the idea for Moby Dick. And that ship would have been throughout the Pacific, and this is by the 1820s. So they only came around the Cape Horn at the end of the 19th century. So, 18th century. So by 1820, they had already pretty well explored quite a bit of the Pacific, and so this ship wrecked in Hawaii, and we've since recovered some artifacts from it, which have now been conserved, and an exhibit has been created at Nantucket, so at the Whaling Museum in Nantucket, and that helps to sort of try and explain to people that it was such a global enterprise. It wasn't something that, you know, they just went out offshore here, because it was an ever-expanding industry, because they constantly depleted their supplies on the known grounds.
There were opportunities to learn about all sorts of aspects of whaling while aboard the Charles W. Morgan. At one point, Dave Wiley, research coordinator for Stellwagen Bank National Marine Sanctuary, noticed an original oak bucket that still held the smell of whale.
Oh, can you describe the odor of whale? Let's think. If you took something, left it out, take a piece of fat, leave it out on your driveway for 4 years, and then take your foot and grind it into the piece of wood, maybe that might come close. But it's a very distinct smell. Once you get used to it, you never forget it.
Let's get that four stays all around.
It's not a bad smell, at least in there.
No, you're getting a whiff of it from, you know, what, 150 years ago or 100 years ago, maybe. So it's pretty rich when it's fresh.
As the day's activities wound down and the Charles W. Morgan headed back to harbor, a new sound emerged on deck. Gary Wickfors is a fishery scientist by day, but an avid folk music player and composer.
Yeah, no, this is called a Walzer. It's a string instrument made in Germany in the 1840s. And that was my project, is to bring this instrument made same time as the boat here, and it's a kind of instrument that would be used to play folk tunes, and there's a great diversity of cultural heritage in the crews of the first 37 voyages, and my idea is to use this experience being on this boat, which has been wonderful, to compose some new tunes, instrumental music that might have occurred by this mix, ethnic mix. And there's two tunes that last night between about 11 and half past midnight I composed sitting on this bench. And they both had a very Portuguese or Azorean kind of feel. That last one I just played, they don't have names yet. And they may not be done yet. I may change them still. Find them, do professional recordings of them, and provide the tunes to the Seaport. Hope they find a use for them in the 38th voyage presentations.
So you are, as I understand it, a fishery scientist most of the time.
I am. That's my profession. I manage a biotechnology program for the NOAA's National Marine Fisheries Service at an aquaculture lab in Milford, Connecticut. But this is my my pretty serious avocation of playing traditional folk music on string instruments. I didn't come here as a scientist, actually. I looked at some phytoplankton in the microscope and made some identifications. But this is more of a cultural contribution, is how I see it, to recognize that on these whaling boats, which were mainly, America was the leader in whaling, people from every culture around the world came together on these boats. It's not such a big place to spend 3 years, and so there had to be a lot of cultural exchange, and so that's really what I was working on, rather than the science. I mean, science, the way I see it and approach it, is a quantitative pursuit. So it's about numbers, and it's about how those numbers relate to each other. I mean, in physics, everything is about an equation that describes how two objects relate to each other, how they move relative to each other. In music, everything about it is mathematics. There are intervals of time, so there's a beat, and then there's intervals of tone. So that's two things going on. There's intervals in two domains, and that is very much like a lot of simple math and a lot of math that you would use to describe other natural phenomena. In a way, being here, I've been thinking of the cultures of people, but also listening to the sounds of the boat, of the crew working together, the rhythms of them pulling the lines in, and that has to be at a certain speed, and a certain, everyone has to pull at the same speed and at the same distance. That's just like music. It's got to be in the same meter, the same time. And if it's going to harmonize or be playing together, there has to be a congruence between the tones. So, and that makes harmony. And harmony is what makes a crew work together on a boat. You'd use that word. So I see, science and a lot of the human interaction here and music as all having this mathematical basis that allows you to express one with the other in a way. You could write an equation for this.
Stand by the main lift.
It's got arithmetic. It's all arithmetic.
Scientist and musician Gary Wickfors. Until next week, this is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab On the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone, with assistance from Jenny Junker and Alicia Orsini. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment. Additional support is provided by Lee McGraw through the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. Living Lab is a production of WCAI, the local NPR station for the Cape, the Coast, and the Islands.